This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. William T. Brown. Today is the 23rd of March, 2006. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Bill is at his home in Fort Worth. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, mate.
First of all, sir, I want to ask, where were you born and when?
I was born in Alabama, the 19th day of September, 1919, in a log house.
Tell me a little bit about your family, about your parents.
Well, I had a mama and a daddy, and I have two sisters. There were three of us in the family.
Mm-hmm.
I was the oldest, and then my two sisters.
Now, what did your dad do for where in Alabama was this?
Pardon?
Where in Alabama?
Little town called Hartford, Alabama. It's over in the peanut section, just south of Fort Rucker.
And tell me about your dad. What did he do for a living?
Oh, he was a farmer all his life.
Hard work.
Yes. In fact, after I was born in the same log house that he was born in, and then we moved in another log house. It was on a 40 acres of land that he bought. And my two sisters, I talked to them last night, and they were at home in Mama's kitchen eating supper.
In the same house.
Us three kids still have the old home place.
No kidding. That's quite remarkable. Your dad, he was a farmer. What kind of crops did he farm?
Cotton, corn, and peanuts, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got into cows a little later. Of course, 40 acres, you couldn't have a ranch, you know.
No, that's right.
But we had our milk cows, and we grew our hogs for meat, you know, and had our chickens for. And we survived the Depression, that's for sure, in that state of living, you know.
Now, you would have been a young man during the Depression. You were, what, 13, 14, around that?
Well, I was, when I was born in 1919, we moved over onto the farm in the same year. So I grew up in that log house.
I see.
And then I went on to school and graduated from high school in Hartford, Alabama.
And what year did you graduate?
1938.
Tell me a little bit about the high school. How many kids in your class?
Oh, probably about 25.
And what kind of a student were you, Bill?
Well, I suppose I was okay in everything but math.
Is that right?
I got a whipping for not failing a math, an algebra test. That was in the days when the board was the extra help, you know.
Yes, sir. Well, did you like your other subjects?
Pardon?
Did you enjoy your other subjects besides
math?
Yeah. What was your favorite?
Oh, I don't know really if you want to think about it. I just took it as it came, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose
mm-hmm.
English, I suppose, was the best.
Did you play sports?
No, nothing but I wasn't in football or baseball, you know. We just had athletics, you know.
Oh, sure.
That's all.
Yeah. Now, did you have to work as well as a young man?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
I thought you might.
Every Thanksgiving, we'd strip cane to make. That's how we made our syrup. And Daddy would wait till the holidays so we could dig sweet potatoes and strip the cane.
Bill, for someone who doesn't know what that means, can you describe what stripping the cane was?
Well, cane has a blade on it. It goes all the way up to the top, and it's in joints.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And you have to pull the fodder or the blades off, and then you have the bare stalk of cane. And you take that and put it in a mill that is pulled by a mule going round and round and round, and that crushes the juice out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the juice is cooked, and it finally comes out as syrup.
That's an awful lot of work, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Hard work. Well, and you said that your dad would save up the sweet potatoes?
Yeah.
As well?
We took the sweet potatoes. We dug those and we put them in a hill, like if it was making charcoal, it's mounded up,
mm-hmm.
and then deer and put pine straw or fodder, corn fodder on there to protect, because we had put a layer of soil over that. It might sort of like a teepee, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then all during the winter when we need some more potatoes, we'd scratch a hole in the side of it and take those potatoes out and use them.
I'll be darned. Well, I mean, there's so much work involved in that. Did you ever work off the farm? Did you ever work for cash money in town?
The first work that we did, living on a farm, there's no machinery to harvest the corn or the cotton or the peanuts, thing like that.
No machinery at all.
No, it was all done by hand, and that's labor.
Yes, sir.
And if we caught up with our work and I went over to a neighbor's and helped them, maybe they'd pay us a minimum amount to help, you know. And then after that, we got a peanut mill in Hartford, Alabama, where you take the peanuts and they
mm-hmm.
run them through a sheller.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a job. That's the first job I ever had, really. That's when my Social Security number was given to me. And after that, it was, well, see, when I was in high school, mm-hmm. I was in the National Guard.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
And I liked the National Guard. And one time during the year, we'd go on, say, a two-week cruise, not cruise, but, you know, in the forest.
Like out on a exercise or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And we had the guns and everything like that. And I liked that. And then after I graduated from high school, I could see I could never make it on a farming, you know. So I decided to join the Navy.
Now, what year did you decide to join the Navy?
In 1940, 18th day of April, 1940.
Now, do you remember, did you talk to a recruiter, or how did this come about?
Well, I had to find out where a recruiting station was.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
There was one in Marianna, Florida. And a cousin of mine and I, we thumbed our way to this post office recruiting station.
Uh-huh.
And my cousin was so tall, they said, we can't use this. And they said to me, you go back home and eat some peas and cornbread and put some weight on and then come back.
is that pretty much what happened? You had to go back?
I had to do it, and then I went back another time, and they took me in.
Now, what about your cousin? What happened to him?
Well, not then, but later on, you know, the war got such that he went into the Air Corps.
Oh, sure. Okay.
They'd take anything after the war started.
Well, that's right. Yes,
see,
sir.
All this is before mm-hmm. we were in the war.
That's right, yeah, 1940. Uh-huh. Well, what made you pick the Navy?
What made me pick it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, on a rainy day back home on the farm, we couldn't work, and we'd get a box full of pictures and start looking at them. And one picture in there was my uncle in a naval uniform with the old flat hat that they wore at that time.
Sure.
Uh-huh. And I said, my gosh, that's nice. Wouldn't it be nice if I could have a uniform like that? And so that's why I did it.
Wow. Well, once you'd have fattened up a little bit, and they decided to let you in there in April of 1940. Did they swear you in right there, or what happened?
No. I went to Marianna, and we got, me and two other fellas got on a bus, two other recruits, got on the bus and went to Birmingham, Alabama. And that's where I saw my first, the train, you know, that went goes around, like in New Orleans. It's your ride in a town, years ago.
Oh, like a tram or
a
railway or something?
Uh-huh. It is a railway, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And that's the first time you saw that? Was it Birmingham?
Yeah, that's the first time I ever saw one of those, or ever rode one. And that's where we took our allegiance to the United States and the flag right there.
Okay, and after you were sworn in, did they take you to a training facility somewhere?
Yes.
Where did you go?
Norfolk, boot camp was in Norfolk, Virginia.
Well, how did you get up there?
By bus.
That's quite a ride.
Yes.
Had you ever been out of Alabama much before? I mean, you'd been over to Florida.
Went to Florida. That's it.
That's it. So this would be one of your first trips out of.
I was seeing the world then.
Yes, sir.
You know, the sign says, join the Navy and see the world. Well, that's when I started right there.
Well, what did you make of Norfolk when you got there? What did you make of it? What did you experience? How did it look to you?
A lot of people, now all the other boots already there, so they'd see the new recruits coming in, they'd stick their head out the fence and say, you'll be sorry, you'll be sorry.
Did they really?
No, I wasn't sorry. I struck right in with it. Of course, I was born and raised to obey, you know, and to do the right thing, and I made it fine right along with the recruits and fell in right in with it.
Now, when you say that you were born and raised to obey, are you talking about your family and your father? Would he have kind of set that tone? What about your sisters, the same way?
Yes, and both of those went through high school and made nurses.
They both became nurses?
Uh-huh.
Where did they study, do you know?
Well, we had a hospital.
Oh, uh-huh.
We had a hospital in Dothan, Alabama, which is about 50 miles from the farm.
Yes, sir.
And they had a place to keep the girls there.
A dormitory or something.
Uh-huh. And they got their training and then cleaned the halls and the bedpans. They got their natural experience, you know.
Oh, yes, sir. On the job training. Did they serve in the war time?
No, not neither one.
They both, but they remained there in Alabama?
Yeah.
And they're still living at home now?
Yeah. Both married.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And had their families in Alabama.
Sure.
And both of them lost their husband within a seven-month period.
Oh, dear.
And they never married anymore, so.
So now they are taking care of each other, my guess.
Yeah. Well, have the joy of going home and sitting on the front porch.
Well, it sure sounds nice.
Yes.
Do they come out and visit you much, sir?
Very, very seldom.
Have you been back to Alabama?
After I came to Texas, I would go home every year. I called it my safari back to my holy land. And then I had to take it less, and now it's been quite a little while since I was there. My sisters have been out here since I went over there.
Mm. Now, because it's hard work getting back and forth, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
It gets worse all the time.
Well, and I know that. I believe you, and it does get harder. Well, let me ask you about your training there at Norfolk. What did they put you through? Do you remember?
See, we were in quarantine for, I think it was 2 weeks.
Now, why was that?
Well, that's behind the wire fence.
Oh, I see. Yes,
the dormitory is within that. We marched everything that we did outside that, we marched to it. to chow every time you marched, and then you came back. We washed our own clothes and hung them up there. We cleaned the barracks and made our own beds and kept our clothes. And then after that, we got into the drill fields, you know, with all the drilling.
Yeah.
And, by the way, I had the joy of going to my baby granddaughter's graduation from the boot camp in Great Lakes Training Station.
What year was that?
That was last year.
And she's in the Navy right now?
Yes, she is.
Where is she stationed, sir? Do you know?
It's up north. It's the only one that's left now. All the others are closed.
But here in the States, she's in the States?
Huh?
She's here in the United States?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Uh-huh. What is her specialty?
Well, right now she's working on a computer. At the Naval Station there, they have a place for the submarines.
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
They can't go to it and go in it, but she's working outside of that on a computer. I talked to her yesterday.
Did you really? Well, you must be just as proud as you can be of her.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Yes. You know, we couldn't even go home or call home, and it took a long time to get a letter. But now with these cell phones, my granddaughter, she's just calling me off and on all the time. You know, I says, I joined too soon.
That's right. You did. You should have waited a couple 40 years or so.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like they put you through a lot of marching.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of drilling. But how did you take to it?
Well, I took to it real good because I have a picture. I was picked the whole platoon, 48. I forget how many's in there, but I have a picture on the wall in the little house I was talking about with all of us. And I was the platoon picked me as the number one man.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's got a word for it, but right now my 86 years keeps us from remembering it.
That's all right. If it comes to you, you can just pop it in.
Yeah.
But you were the head man, essentially.
Yeah, well, yeah, and there was four platoons, and each one had a number one man, and at sometime during the graduation, we were invited over into Norfolk, Virginia, to some kind of dinner. It might have been some kind of league or something like that, and was recognized there, the four of us.
Now, were you paying much attention to the development of conflict over in Europe and so on at this time?
Come again, not me.
Were you watching the news were you aware that the war was ongoing already in Europe at this time?
Then?
Yes.
At that time?
Yeah.
Lord, no, I didn't.
No.
See, that was something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you'll get to it or not or what, but when I left the training station in Norfolk, and then I went to California, and the Louisville heavy cruiser was anchored outside of San Pedro.
Yes, sir.
I went in after dark. It came and got us off the dock out there after dark, and I took my sea bag and all on my shoulder and went up a long gangway up to the main deck of the Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning, we pulled anchor and started on a goodwill tour to South America.
Now, tell me a little bit about that. Did you know where you were going to go, or did you know it was a goodwill tour?
Not until the next morning when we pulled out.
Okay.
I didn't know. And we went down and went through the canal and went into South America and went up and down different cities. This is called a goodwill trip.
Well, Bill, do you remember going through the canal?
Oh, God, yeah.
Tell me about that, because that's pretty exciting.
You know, you had to go up or down, whichever ocean is the other.
Uh-huh.
And it's like going through a channel. On each side is the high banks, you know, and if you read about the mosquitoes and the layer and all that kind of stuff, you know,
for sure. Can
see how it was.
Yes, uh-huh.
And that was on the trip to South America.
Uh-huh.
And we made it through fine at that time. And after our trips to Rio de Janeiro and all the Brazilian stations along there, we wound up in Bahia, Brazil, and it was Christmas time.
What happened?
That's where a lot of the coffee and everything like that. And so we were in no hurry. I didn't know anything about the war. Heck, we were just having a good time going up down there and showing our ship to the people in there.
Now, Bill, let me stop you for a minute and ask you,
how did
you show them the ship? Did people get to walk on, or did you dock it?
Oh yeah, we tied up to the dock,
and
the people would go along the dock in the afternoon at the flag raising, or in the morning the flag raising, but mostly in the afternoon when the Marines, we had Marines on there, and they did the flag. And blow the bugle, you know, and everything like that. And that, and then we'd have a day when they could come aboard. The people there in that town could come aboard.
Uh-huh.
We had to have that ship spotless, you know.
Oh, yes, sir.
Because we was making a good show, you know.
Now, did people come by the hundreds to see the ship?
Oh, yeah.
Were you,
yeah.
I mean, you must have been overrun with people wanting to see
it.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm
that's
sure.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, did you get out and about in any of the towns that you visited?
Yes. We had had liberty, you know.
Sure.
And we'd have, in Buenos Aires, we had open, I have pictures of it, like a bus, but there's no top on it. And we'd sit in there, and we went all around and sightseeing.
Sure.
Sightseeing.
Uh-huh.
And the grass spay, the British had knocked out the grass spay of the German ship, you know.
Now, this was at, what, Montevideo or something?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about
that. I think that was Buenos Aires.
Oh, is that right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Tell me, what did you see of the Grass Bay? What did you see of it?
Well, we could see part of it sticking up, the bow. And then, of course, there wouldn't be any caskets on the beach, you know, on the docks.
Well,
but
no,
we got pictures of that. And that's all we saw of that. Then after we made up and down the coast of South America,
mm-hmm.
We got an announcement that we was going to go to sea. And we didn't know where we was going.
Now, this is a new mission.
Yeah.
Where were you when you found out about it, that you were going on?
Tied up to the dock in Bahia, Brazil.
Okay, so that's where you were.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And let me ask you, Bill, as, you know, the war is... was clearly on. You could see the sunken Graf's Bay out there. You knew the war was on.
Yeah.
Did you have worries? I mean, the Louisville was a heavy cruiser, so
yes, that's right.
She'd make a good target for a submarine. Did you have any worries at all?
Well, not really, because I wasn't that far ahead of it, you know.
Understood.
And when we left, got out to sea, the captain announced where we was going,
uh-huh.
that we was headed for Africa.
South Africa?
Uh-huh.
Now, did you really know where that was?
No. I wasn't that good in geography.
I would have to agree with you. So, what did he tell you you were... Well, first of all, Bill, let me clear...
He told us that's where we was going.
I see.
Okay, we got in there... one afternoon.
Now, you mean you arrived in South
Africa?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And where was
we tied it up to the dock.
Do you know what port it was?
Yeah.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say, was it Simonstown or?
Yeah, that's where it was, Simonstown.
Okay, uh-huh.
And they had when we got up, they put a net under the gangway. And we started lining up, and on the deck we had a mess table and be an officer there, and there was stacks of gold over on the dock.
And
there was one guard over there with a rifle. I don't know if it was one of theirs or what, but when we got there, we put the Marines over there to guard it, and we marched from before daylight. We marched all day long going back and forth up that gangway with only one brick of gold. That's all we could take.
Each man had one.
And it had a number on it. And when we got to the first officer at the mess table, he would record that. And then we'd take it up to another deck and another table, and they record the number. And it went on down into the ammunition rooms, where they had a Marine outside the door of that, and it was stored in that.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that all day long until late at night. So, and then the next morning we shoved off coming to New York. And then that's when I realized the war, because the sailmakers made big flags, United States flags, and put them up where they could be seen from a long distance on the port side and on the starboard side and amidship.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that's so that they'd know we were not in the war. That submarines were somewhere then, you know.
Yes, sir.
And we headed for New York, and when we got to New York, the armored cars and guards and everything, and here we'd pick that gold up on with one guy watching it, you know. And the record is, it's in the naval history, at that time, it was the largest shipment of gold that had ever been moved.
Now, How heavy was the bar you had to carry, Bill?
We carried it from Simonstown to Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Yep, and each of those bars, how much did they weigh? Any idea?
Oh gosh, I don't know. But I wrote a story about the gold stuff, and in that story it was published in the American Heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they edited out some of the most important part, because we got in a storm between Simonstown and Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And one man was washed overside, but thank God we rescued him. You know.
How did that rescue happen? Do you remember it?
Yes.
Can you tell me about it?
It was late in the afternoon,
uh-huh.
And an albatross, a big bird, had been following us every time we left Simonstown,
uh-huh.
And was just going low over the water. And about sundown, the storm was so bad, the ship was rolling and everything, and a whole body of water just come across the quarterdeck, and this one man was washed over the side.
Did you see that happen, Bill?
I was standing, me and one of my shipmates, and was watching. And I can remember seeing that wall of water coming, and I saw something go off on the starboard side. It came from the port side.
Right.
And we hollered man overboard, and then, of course, the man on watch, and they sounded the call. And then one of the yeomen, he got up on the top mast and with a long telescope.
Yes.
And kept looking, and the captain was backing down and moving and everything.
Yes.
And the waves were so tall, and finally we located it. And he was going up and down, and he said the worst trouble he had, there was that albatross striking at him out there as he'd come up on a wave.
The bird would come after him?
Yes. And he said he'd already took his shorts off and his shoes, you know. And he thought he could see the smoke from the stack on the Louisville. And he said, well, they'll never see me. But we did, and we put a whaleboat out there. And the storm was so bad it beat it against the starboard side of the ship.
Yeah.
And so they had to give up. We kept maneuvering, and it was lucky. In fact, the guy's name was Lucky.
Uh-huh.
And we called him Lucky Lucky.
And Lucky Lucas?
Yeah, and finally got him on deck. And after that, still on the way to Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
Had a little show on the quarterdeck one night to pass the time, and he told us all about how he felt and the appreciation for us getting him.
How did they actually retrieve him?
We got close enough, threw a line out to him, and he took hold of it.
So they actually got the ship over close enough to him.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And what about those guys that were in the little whaler that tried to go out?
Oh, well, it was about four in there, because
uh-huh.
it had a motor in it, you know.
Yes.
And they saw they couldn't handle it, so they got it back upside the ship and hooked a line on it, and it just pulled it up the long way, not broadside, but the long way.
Just right up from the end.
Yeah.
Well, he could have lost those four guys.
That's right.
That was extremely brave of them.
And that's one of the things they left out of my story when they published in an American Heritage.
Right. Well, we've got it now. We've got it here. It's an incredible story. Well, what else did Lucas tell you about? What did he think about when he was out there? Did he tell you?
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine. But...
Yeah, I can only imagine, you know.
Mm.
And
about how long was he out in the water? Do you know?
Oh,
Bill?
Maybe an hour or so.
Oh, I just can hardly believe he survived.
I don't. He just didn't give up, and he was just trying to stay afloat, you know, and hoping that we would. And it's hard to imagine what thoughts he did have, you know.
Well, it is hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine. Him in the cold water.
That's right.
Being able to stay alive. Maybe that pesky bird was actually the key to the whole thing.
Well, he said if we'd have known that he was trying to get a hold of him, it'd have been easy. We could have kept track of him, you know. But
you could have watched the bird.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Isn't that a strange thing? Well, were you one of the guys who actually had to carry the gold?
Oh, from the dock up, over to the ship?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's no telling how many bricks during the day. It was just back and forth, one man behind another, you see.
Now, what did you think when you had one of those gold bars
in
your hand?
Oh, my God. That was better than that little bit of money that I kept from helping a man pick his cotton, you know.
Oh, I bet you thought, this is a lot of cotton right here.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, tell me about arriving at New York at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Do you remember that, Bill?
Oh, yes. We'd been at sea so long, you
yes.
know, and
yes.
everything. We was glad we saw first thing we saw almost was that.
Oh,
the one with the torch.
Statue of Liberty.
Statue of Liberty, you know. And when we got there, and a number of armored cars and the policemen and everything like
mm-hmm.
that. And we went in dry dock there after we got rid of the gold.
Now, was that because the ship needed some maintenance?
Yeah,
or?
Uh-huh.
And what did you do during that time?
Well, I went on Liberty one time in Brooklyn, the first time I've ever been there, and that's on my first snow there, and I tell you, I couldn't stand that stuff going down my collar.
It's pretty cold, huh?
Yeah.
For an Alabama boy. Was that the first time you'd ever seen snow?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, now, you what can you tell me about your Liberty time there in Brooklyn? What did you do? What did you
Well,
guys...
I just walked. I was by myself.
Uh-huh.
And I just
okay.
walking around and gazing, you know, like a country boy would do.
Oh, sure.
And I remember I went by a barber shop and I stopped in and asked him, did he have any Lucky Tiger hair tonic?
Uh-huh.
And I think he said, there's a Flatlander, you know. And he says, no, says the tiger died. I think he was making fun of me, you know.
I think he might have been. He probably heard your accent.
Yeah.
And thought he'll have a go. Well, now you said you were by yourself.
Yeah.
Were you in uniform all the time?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Since that was something that had attracted you to the Navy in the first place, did you like wearing your uniform around?
Yes, I did. And later on, I got me a tailor-made dress blue uniform. That I wore, you know, on Liberty.
Uh-huh, you had that made.
Yes, by uh-huh. Taylor on the beach, you know.
Oh, yeah. And that was that the only kind of dress uniform that you did have?
No, we had a dress white uniform also.
Uh-huh.
That would be for summer, you know.
Oh, sure.
And the 13 buttons on the front of our dress blues, you know.
Did that have significance? The third.
Yes.
What was the significance of it?
Okay. I remember one time we'd been at sea and I hadn't had any milk for a long time.
You hadn't had any what?
Milk.
Oh, yes, sir.
And, well, I would say that this was after I got on the subchaser and I was riding the bus to come home. And when we got to Key West, Florida, I rode another ship there to get to the mussel pond.
Mm-hmm.
And I drank a lot of buttermilk. Well, we get on the bus heading across the Keys for Miami, and I had to use the bathroom. And I kept going, and I said, well, gosh, I can't hold this much longer. And I went up to the front of the bus, which was packed mm-hmm. and with people, and I said to the bus driver, I got to go to the bathroom. He said, well, there's not one around here because there's water on each side of that highway going up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I said, well, I tell you, you just stop and let me get off.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'll catch the next thing going through. He says, is that bad? I said, yes. And he said, well, let me get over this bridge here. He says, there's a little shack down by the water line.
Mm-hmm.
And says, you can use it. Okay, I left my ditty bag on the bus, and I went out, went around the front of it, down the side of that highway
mm-hmm.
to that little room, and on the way down, I unbuttoned 13 buttons. And when I got there to open the door, the wind was blowing, and it was blowing it shut. I said, well, like the heck with that. And when I got back on the bus, my seatmate, which is a sailor, he says, boy, you sure look funny. He said, you look right. I said, I don't care if it if the Queen of Sheba had been on here, I still had to go to the bathroom.
That's right. You got.
And I was telling an old farmer friend of mine back home when I got home on Liberty
uh-huh.
about it. He says, look, son, says, don't ever hold it. this whole world is too big.
Well, I think that was probably some good advice.
Yes. But you know, you remember things like...
Well, you sure do.
It's a part of the game.
That's right. It's part of life.
Uh-huh.
Let me ask you about getting onto the sub-chaser. Now, this was the 1302, is that right?
1302.
Yeah, 1302. And what... did it have a name?
Okay, let me... When I went... After I got on the Louisville, I was a gunner's mate striker.
Okay, yes, sir.
I was planning to take care of the guns, you see.
Yes.
And I had a 5-inch 25 that I worked on. Then somebody put my name in the pot to go to the gunnery school in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I left Louisville and went to Washington, the Navy gun factory in Washington.
Okay.
Started my schooling there, and I'd go from one factory. Next one was Long Island, New York, where they manufactured parts for the gun. And the next one was, I don't know, there's about four of them that wound me up in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And you had to go to some training at each one of these
places? Yeah, each one of those towns that I went to.
Okay.
Detroit was one of them.
Sure, that sounds
and,
right.
About four of them. And one was in Minneapolis and Long Island and like this Schenectady, New York. That was the other one. And after I left Minneapolis, I went to the receiving station in California, waiting for a ship. And it seemed like I'd never find one. And so,
how long were you in California waiting?
Oh, I don't know. Must have been a month or more.
Okay.
And finally. I wound up at the Terminal Islands Federal Prison, and I was living not in the prison but in the houses that had taken away from the Japanese, you know, the fishermen.
Yes.
And put them in a wire cage, I suppose you'd say.
In a what?
No.
In a cage?
Yeah, you know, where they put them.
Yeah, they interned them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so I got my instructions. While I was at Terminal Island post.
Yes, sir.
And we got on a train and went to Miami, Florida.
All the way back over the country.
Yeah. Huh?
All the way to Miami.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
All the way to Miami. Uh-huh. And when we got there, went to the sub-chaser training school, which was, it was on Biscayne Boulevard. And we went through the training school there, and when we got finished with that, we went up to Jacksonville, Florida, where they manufactured the 1302. And we, a crew of us went up there, and we brought the subcase of 1302, which is an all-wooden ship, 110 feet long, about 14 feet wide, a crew of 25 people, officers and men. And we came back to Miami, and we were commissioned there.
Were you at the commissioning ceremony?
Yes. Uh-huh.
What can you tell me about that?
Well, there were some officials there, you know.
Some big shots?
Yeah.
From Miami or from the Navy?
In the Navy.
Uh-huh.
I got on my note here. Substation 1302 commissioned Tuesday, March the 30th, 1943. And I kept my diaries during the war. Don't tell nobody I did, but I've got a...
No kidding.
I can document everything that I was saying.
Yes,
you know?
Sir.
And after it was commissioned, my place, special C detail, was on the wheel, you know, taking orders from the man up above to tell him where to turn and where not to. But we did some in and out stuff there, and checking out some of the construction and everything.
Now you were going in and out of Jacksonville, just
after we brought it back to Miami.
Oh, I see. After Miami, huh? Uh-huh.
And then when they got it ready for us, well, we was ready to. We didn't know where we went, but we went south. I went to Guantanamo, and right on down, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and all the way down to the Caribbean, and to Trinidad. And there was a body of water between the island of Trinidad and the the country that Venezuela.
Venezuela.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Sure.
It called the Bocas, that lived part of the water. Well, I was on the wheel, like I tell you, that was my job.
Yes.
And the water was so rough going through there, the captain took me off the wheel because I couldn't keep it going straight, and he knew the channel was mine,
uh-huh.
and he put the boatswain mate on the wheel. But we got through, and there in a little cove in the island of Trinidad was some docks there, piers, and we went in and tied up that. And that was our home port all for the rest of the war.
Was Trinidad.
Yeah, and the Gulf of Paria there, and big ships would come in there on their training and everything.
Uh-huh.
And our job was to search for German submarines, you know, that started out sinking everything we had on the East Coast, you know.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And we had we didn't have torpedoes. We had mine.
Depth charge, or what did
you
have?
Depth charges, uh-huh. and a 1/4 millimeter gun is the biggest gun we had. Can you picture us facing a submarine that had a 3-inch gun on it?
It's not a happy thought.
Thank God we never come face to face. We bombed a lot of fish, I suppose, because we thought we had a submarine under there, and it didn't work out that way. But
now, did you have Bill? Did you have a sonar capability, or how were you locating subs?
Had sound gear.
Yeah, sound gear. Yep. Uh huh. And what did you lower it over the side, or how did you?
No. It was some kind of machine that would pick it up, you know.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And you said that there was real rough water in that channel there near Venezuela.
Yeah.
And that it was mined?
Yes, it was. And part of our job on as the war went along and everything was when we found a floating mine in the Gulf of Paria was found,
yes.
then we would go out and blow it up with the 200 millimeters or the 40 millimeters.
So you'd get some gun practice shooting at the mines?
Huh?
You would get some gun practice by shooting at
that's right.
shooting at the mines and blowing them up?
Yeah, we'd rather shoot at that than the rise of a submarine.
Well, yes, sir. I can well imagine.
Uh-huh.
Now, Bill, I've got to ask you about one of the members of your crew. Who was shorter than everybody else, and that was Queenie. I want to ask how did you come by Queenie?
Well, we was in San Juan, Puerto Rico, tied up side of another sub chaser,
mm-hmm.
and they came in and they had a big dog on board.
A big dog?
Yeah, a mm-hmm. bigger dog.
Uh-huh.
And they said, "Look, we got a little puppy over here, and would you like to have it?" And says our captain says you can't have but one dog on here. So I had to go, and I asked the officer, the captain, about it, and he said no, it'd be too much mess.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, we'll take care of that. To make a long story short, well, he decided to do it, and he became a fan of Queenie's also. In fact, I'm looking at that picture right here, and Captain Scott, in another little picture, he's got Queenie and they're sitting on an ammunition box, you know.
I'm actually looking at a copy of that picture now,
yeah.
too.
And that's how we got the Queenie. And,
now, she's sitting on the ammo box. Who's that with her? Is that the captain with her?
Yeah, at that time.
What was his name? Do you remember?
Scott.
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Morgan, I'm looking at the big picture, and Mr. Morgan, that I kept contact after I got contact with him after the war,
uh-huh.
and it was the most enjoyable thing. He seemed to enjoy talking on the phone to me and sending uh-huh. me books and everything, and of course he died, and that was a loss to me. Because,
well, sure.
And,
yes, sir.
So.
Well, let me ask you about, did Queenie kind of, Was she sort of special to you particularly?
Yes, and I took her. I would take her to the vet. They had a vet in Trinidad, the town,
mm-hmm.
and she had a disease in the ear. And I'd take her on the bus and take her over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her because I'd always had pets, you know.
Yes, sir.
And she took to me. And Pete Lozier was in this picture, he was from he was an old wood cutter, you know, and she loved him and he loved her. But when Pete would go on the beach and get a little tanked up and come back.
Yes, sir.
And he'd call Queenie and she'd go to him. And when she smelled his breath, she'd start turning her head away from him. And he'd start talking. And, oh, baby, don't worry about me. I'm all right. But that dog. And, you know, when I started getting in touch with some of my shipmates on that, one of the first things they do is say, they called me Brownie on there.
Yep.
Say, Brownie, what happened to Queenie? And I'd have to tell them, you know, that she stayed on the farm. Queenie, in one of these pictures, as you turn the page, she's standing up on a box.
Yes, sir, I see her.
Okay. Well, I made that box. And I put her name on it, and in Charleston, South Carolina, where we decommissioned the substation,
mm-hmm.
I took it and put it on the train with Queenie in it. And I was on the train.
Yes.
And I told the people back there to take care of her. I had water in there and everything. You know that box is still in the barn on that 40-acre farm over there?
Is it really?
Yeah.
I can't imagine how you managed to get her with you, to keep her with you while you were decommissioned and get her home. How did you manage it?
Oh, it was easy.
Was it?
Yeah, and every time the train would stop, I'd go back to the car,
yeah.
Baggage car, and put my hand in it, I had a smell of it and everything, you know.
So she would know that you were
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that I was, and we rode the same little boat over to the beach in Charleston, and she was right on in there with me, you know, And then we got down to the station.
Well, and Bill, was she happy on the farm?
Oh, yeah.
And how long did she live, Bill?
Let's see. She died. I went to Auburn University and got a degree in algae science. And,
yes, sir.
And then I was working in three different boats in Alabama. And she was there with Mom and Daddy. And she mm-hmm. just loved it there, you know.
Oh, sure.
I had plenty of room to walk around and everything.
Uh-huh. And she was a good, she was a, as good a dog on land as she was on sea, I guess.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, you said, I'm reading the article, which,
yeah, I know.
Which is in Pet Life, and it says that she had good sea legs. Did she ever hit water where it kind of did upset her, or was she would manage it, no problem?
At home?
Well, actually back on the ship.
On the deck?
Yeah, on the deck.
Well.
Good sea legs?
If she had to mess up the deck a little bit, I swore to the captain that I'd clean it up, you know, and it wasn't that bad. And when we left Trinidad coming to Miami, we was all worried about her because we didn't think she was going to the bathroom. And
oh, yeah.
When we got there and got tied up to the dock, the first thing we did, we put the leash on Queenie and took her on the dock.
Uh-huh.
You know? Everybody conscious about her.
Sure,
know?
Sure. And what happened?
Well, you know.
She was okay.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, dogs are funny that way sometimes.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I'm so glad that you got to keep her. And Bill, if you can, would you say something about what she meant to the guys on the ship?
A little. It was almost like they was petting one of their children. And they'd wash her, you know, give her a bath, you know, and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And take her. And when they were on watch, Queenie would, at night, you know.
Yes.
And there was a seat on the starboard side and on the port side up on the lookout tower. And Queenie, they'd take Queenie up there and put her in the chair. And if it's raining, they'd take the raincoat and cover her up.
No.
Just not to disturb her, you know. They love that dog. That's, like I say, Brownie, what happened to Queenie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
After it was over.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what they cared about.
Yeah. And
sure. Well, they must have all been very glad to know that you got her home.
Yeah. And another thing,
mm-hmm.
It's funny that I would happen home, like this article said, and Mama said, "Well, Dada's out getting ready to bury Queenie," and we put her in a good box and cover. right there where my sisters are right now.
Right there in the yard somewhere.
Yeah, and I wrote on the concrete while it was wet, you know, that she was there, and when she died, she was on the ship and everything like that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it's still there on the farm.
Uh-huh.
Still, Bill, let me ask you about going to school. You went to Auburn, you said.
Yes. I went on a GI Bill, the best thing that ever happened to me, because I'd never been able to make it otherwise, you know.
Now, tell me about that. How did the GI Bill work?
How much longer we got? Did we have a little break?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
How,
Bill, can you tell me how the GI Bill actually worked?
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. It was three of us from the same community there in that peanut section in Alabama that went on the GI Bill and went to Auburn. And then there's another guy that was in another county in Alabama, mm-hmm. and he was there. And we all lived in the same dormitory.
Now, did you all study the same thing?
No. One was studying engineering, and one of us was studying dairying cattle.
Sure.
And then my other fellow, we had agricultural science.
And is that what you did?
We went, we didn't take a break, we was on a quarter system, and we went just steady all the way through.
Right through. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and finished in 3 years. And then I got a job with the Soil Conservation Service in Alabama and went to work in Cullman County. Worked there for about a year, 9 months, and mm-hmm. And then I went to another county, Lauderdale County, that joins Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
And I worked about 9 months there, and then I was transferred to Mobile, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
where I was the district conservationist down there, had the whole county.
So they promoted you.
Yes. uh-huh. This was steps, you know,
yes, sir.
To be promoted.
Yes, sir.
And the work was with farm people on conservation, conserving the soil and the timber and the grass and stuff like that.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Some of the most likable people you ever wanted to work with. The first thing they always offered you was when you got there to help them, let's go have a cup of coffee.
I absolutely believe you. Well, they're good people in that part of the world, good people there. You know, your GI Bill paid for your whole education, did it?
Yeah.
And you said it was one of the best things that ever happened for you.
Yeah, because I don't know if I'd ever got a job or I'd had the ambition to go to college. And while I was there, to begin with, it was in July.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hot, and
yeah.
I was taking American history.
Yes, sir.
And the class was boys and some girls in the old GI uniforms that they, you know, wear.
Were they really?
Yes, and that place was swamped with ex-military people.
Sure.
And I remember when we went through the gate to the campus, there's a little girl there, and they had what they call a rant cap
uh-huh.
for the new students to take. And one of the old guys, ahead of them, I don't know what he'd been in. He'd been in the military. And she said, she put the cap on his head, and he took it, put it on his head. He said, honey, says you wear that. I don't need that. In other words, I've come not to fool around.
I've come
to get an education.
I'm here to get my degree.
Right.
Well, somewhere in here, you must have met your wife, sir.
Well, yeah.
Where did you meet
remember
her?
When I was going around to these gun factories making parts for a gun?
Yes, I do. Long Island, when you were in Long Island?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But when I got to Minneapolis, Minnesota,
sure.
there was a Lakaya lady, Mom Macario, and she took in us Navy boys that was going to this school,
uh-huh.
and she had a sister that lived in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And Anne, my wife,
uh-huh.
was working somewhere over there in Brooklyn, and she was at the same place, and they were talking, and Mom Macario asked Ann, why don't you write to some of the service people, says be patriotic.
Yeah.
And she says, I have some names here. And she gave it, one was a Marine, I believe Ann said, and one mm-hmm. was a sailor, that was me.
Mm-hmm.
And Ann picked me, got my address, and I was on the sub chaser, and she, I was painting on the side of the sub chaser in Trinidad, and the guy on watch come over and looked over at me. He said, "Brownie, who's this broad in Brooklyn that you know?" I said, "Look, I never been to Brooklyn but one time in my life, and I didn't see no broads while I was up there."
Good for you. Good for you.
And that was the letter. I wish to my soul I had saved that letter. She started out making all kind of, you know, excuses for doing it and everything.
Oh, sure.
Well, we kept calling.
You wrote her back.
Wrote her back, naturally, you know. Nothing else to do on there. I had submarines and write to somebody. And, there was,
yes,
and she sent me a picture, and I liked the picture, and I still have that picture.
Oh, how sweet.
And we kept writing. And then when the war was over and I had more points than I needed to get out, but they wouldn't let me out because I signed up for 6 years, and that's what they said, you're going to stay.
Yes, sir.
So I went in on the 18th day of April. In 1940, and I got out on the 18th day of April of 1946, almost the same time of day at the air station in New Orleans. And so when I got my discharge, I took my ditty bag, that's a little thing you carry your shaving gear and stuff like that.
Yes, sir.
And got on the train and headed for Staten Island, New York. Of course, you went into the city, you know.
Yes,
And got there, and I was walking down a walkway there at the railroad station, and I saw this girl by herself coming up to it, and I kept looking at her, you know, and I said, "Gosh, that looks like the one I've been writing to, you know." So she recognized me from my pictures and that, and we met right there, you know. And then later on, I met her family there, and later on, while I was in Auburn, she came down to Auburn and stayed in the hotel there and went with me to the farm and met my family on the farm, you know. And on December the 26th, 1946, we got married. And I said, "If I ever get married again, it won't be the day after Christmas."
Well, and Ann is there with you now, right?
Oh, yeah. She was sitting over here on the end of the table until she went and... Maggie, she's on her sleeping bed, you know.
Yeah,
so
you got the dog there.
Nobody in here but me now.
Well, I couldn't be happier that that you decided to write her back. But
yeah.
But the fact that she wrote you in the first place,
yeah,
that's quite something for a gal in
yeah,
in the 1940s to do that. And you know, that probably happened more times than we think.
God, no.
And she did something wonderful, and it worked out terrifically, it sounds
like.
And you've been happy all this time?
Oh, yeah. She loved the Mobile more than any place we went.
Really?
Of course, while I was in Auburn, our first child was born.
Uh-huh.
While I was in school, and after I got out a little while, you know,
sure,
I went to Staten Island and saw our first child, my son, and they're coming up, he and his family are coming up for Easter here. So,
here in another couple weeks or so?
Yeah, and he graduated from Auburn, too, in engineering, and he lives, his office now is in Houston, Texas.
Oh, so he can come up and visit you in Fort Worth.
And then when we got to Mobile, my only daughter was born down there, so. And
what's your daughter's name?
Her name was Lois Ann.
Now, did she go to school, too?
She went to clothing, like, school, yeah. And she got out of that, and then she worked some with stores, you know. Like, but.
And did she have her own family?
Yeah, she has two boys.
And so your granddaughter, who just came out of boot camp last year up at Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Now, is she your son's daughter?
She's Sue's daughter.
Oh, she's Sue's daughter. So so how many children?
No, not Sue, Lois Ann's daughter.
Oh, Lois Ann. Okay, so how many kids do you and Ann have?
The two grandkids is my...
Those are Lois Ann's.
My boys.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And Lois Ann had two girls.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. One is a Navy and the other works with a wine company in California.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good mix.
Yeah.
You got both ends covered there.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Bill, tell me how you came to live in Texas. How did you move to Texas as part of the soil
you
conservation?
Yeah, I'm redheaded.
Yeah.
I was. Now I'm white.
Yes,
and,
sir.
All of my work was in the field with farmers, you know, stuff like that.
Sure.
And I was having trouble with my skin and the skin specialist. I call them skin scrapers.
Oh, yeah.
He says, why don't you get your job a night watchman and get out of this sunshine? And that was down on the coast where the rays of the sun are terrific, you know. And so I got a chance. They asked me, would I like to come to the training center out here in Fort Worth, which is a government thing that trains new employees to work with the Soil Conservation Service.
Yes, sir.
And I said, yeah, well, you're going to give me a raise? And they said, no, we can't do it. I says, well, I love Mobile County, and so does my family, and we'll stay in Mobile County, where I have so many good friends.
Oh, sure.
And we rocked along. And later they came back and said, we'll give you a raise if you go to the training center in Fort Worth, Texas. So we talked it over and we came, and Ann said we should have never done it. She stayed in Mobile because she loved it down there.
Now, what year did you move out to Fort Worth?
67.
And, it's hard to leave a place you've been all your life. It's pretty hard to leave a place that's hard for you, but she had taken to it. Now, she's a New Yorker, and she loved Mobile.
Yeah, that's right.
She loved Mobile.
Uh-huh.
I'll be darned. Well, she's got good taste. We'll say that. are you both happy now and happy with your job?
I'm looking out the window here at the Carolina Chancellor in bloom. I got a big backyard, and it got a hedge, call it Red Top, and it's red now, and got a big yard, and I just love it because of some space, and we built a little house in the backyard after we came out here because Ann's mother and father needed help.
Sure.
And they didn't have any kids up there, and she was their main tent. So we built a little house. I can see it through the window where I'm sitting now.
Now, and that's where her parents lived for a while?
Till they passed away,
Sure enough. Uh-huh.
And
sure.
Now it's my hideaway.
It's your...
When Ann gets too hot on me here, I go back there.
You've got a retreat.
Yeah. Right there. And my garden's back there, and that's where, when I finish here, I'll be putting some of those tomato plants I got yesterday. And I got two pecan trees in the front yard, and last year I didn't make any, but year before last I had a record crop, and we put them in the deep freeze. And
wonderful. Yummy.
So, we're on a corner lot, got plenty of space, and Maggie, she can get out there and chase squirrels.
That's right. And she can handle the security issues out in the yard.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, let me ask you a couple questions as you think back on your service to the country during World War II, and this is kind of a big picture question, I guess you could say. are you proud of what the United States did during World War II? Was it the right war?
Should we
have fought that war?
Yeah. You see, a man asked. I wanted to. He did a copying machine. I wanted to make it a copy of something for me, and he knew some way that I was in the service during the war.
Yes, sir.
He said, what do you think about when they dropped the bomb on Japan?
Uh-huh.
I says, I was happy. He said, why? I says, because I wanted to go home.
Yes, sir.
And it's a bad thing, but you put an end to it, you know, so everybody can do it. And look how Japan is right now. I didn't do anything great. I did what they told me to do to the best of my ability.
Yes, sir.
And I was proud that I could serve. And I've got a flagpole back here, and the flag is flapping in the breeze right now. And I look out the window, and I can see the wind tousing there.
Now, I am very proud of you for you know, having the flag flying today. It's always important that we do that, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bill, I want to ask you, as time went on, and I know you were busy, you had a family, and you had your job, when the Vietnam War came around, What did you make of that? What did you think of that?
Well, I thought we'd win it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was disappointed when we didn't.
Uh-huh.
And one day, I don't remember whether it was Veterans Day or what, I was taking my morning walk, and I walked by a man's house, and we were shooting the bull with each other, and I found out he was in the service, and I was, too. And I says, well, we've never lost but one war.
Uh-huh.
He says, which one was that? I says, Vietnam.
Yeah.
He says, listen, man. He said, we didn't lose that war.
Uh-huh.
And, boy, did I start backtracking then. I says, I've done said the wrong thing, and I agreed with him. They didn't win it. They just didn't get enough gear to win it.
They didn't have enough time or
that's
they,
right.
something.
Uh-huh. And I felt for them, and I never said anything else about it because I agreed with them. If they'd have left the boys alone, they'd have took them over there, you see.
Yeah. Do you think that that's what the problem was, that the maybe the politicians got in the way or
something
like that?
I read someplace where that they didn't have enough money. It was costing so much money, you know, and they decided to pull out.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of President Johnson? I mean, you moved out here just about the time. Well, he was in office in 1967.
Yeah.
He, big Texan. What did you think of President Johnson?
I suppose I agreed with him, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know that much because I'm not in politics that much.
No, I know that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I'm glad somebody does those jobs. And I asked Ann lately, I wonder how President Bush sleeps at night, you know.
How do you think he sleeps?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I just can't. I woke up at midnight last night.
Uh-huh.
Maggie and I went to bed at 8 o'clock, and at midnight I woke up.
Yeah.
And then I lay there wondering about this, and on the hour I get the news on the radio and think about all the things that are bad that happen in this world.
Uh-huh.
And ye gods, if I had the responsibility of what's going on now, I don't think I'd ever go to bed.
Does it worry you, the war in Iraq?
Yes, it worries me.
I mean, of course, you've got a granddaughter who's in the service, and hopefully she won't be impacted by this too directly, but it's possible that she may do a tour or something. But how do you see it coming to an end? You've seen a lot of wars, sir, and you participated in the biggest one of the last century. What do you think it looks like there in Iraq? Is it a winning proposition? Do you think we're doing the right thing?
It's hard. All these talk shows and the Democrats and the Republicans, and I wish we could join.
I agree.
And
yes, sir.
And do the job, you know.
Yes,
but
sir.
But it's not everybody, but people have ambitions to feather their nest.
Yeah.
And make a name for themselves, you know. And,
uh-huh.
And what we're doing here, not to make a name for me, but to just say about the part that I played in the whole show, you know.
Sure.
And maybe when I left the Louisville,
mm-hmm.
It was in the heart of war. It was camouflaged by two times, and I still have friends, and we have a Louisville convention, you know, and everything.
Now, do you go to reunions? And
no, I haven't been able to go because, but I've been in touch with some of those that do go. You
now,
know?
You keep in touch by telephone with them? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I'm in touch with four of my shipmates on the Subchaser, and we have an organization there, too, you know, and we call and talk to them on the phone. One is in assist place, you know, like a nursing home.
Oh, sure.
Assisted living.
Assisted living.
Yeah.
Sure.
And the Captain Morgan that was in that picture.
Yes.
We're all of us together. He's over on the left next to the captain. You got two officers on and on in.
I see him. What is his name?
George Morgan.
Uh-huh.
And I've been in touch with his family, his wife, and his stepdaughters ever since I got in touch with him.
No kidding.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I've sent them tomatoes and pecans, and they send me things and everything.
Now, where do they live?
Well, they live in Colorado.
Uh-huh, sure, sure.
Yeah, well, George, he died.
Now, when did he die?
Oh, about 2 years ago now.
And
so keep in touch with them.
Yeah.
It's nice, you know.
Now, on the paper, one of the papers that you sent in, Bill, you mentioned the Small Craft Association.
Yeah.
The Patrol Craft Sailors Association.
Yeah.
And is that one group?
Yeah.
Or are those two different groups?
No, it's different. Anybody on the Coast Guard on a small craft could be a member of that, and have destroyer escorts that they were kind of named DE, they're a member of that, and stuff like that.
Yes, sir. Now, do your friends from the associations that you kind of keep in touch with, do you guys talk about the current war or not so much?
Not too much.
Do you kind of shoot the bull about what's going on now? And I'm just wondering what.
Can you put that on hold?
Yes.
Oh.
Bill, I wanted to ask you another couple of questions, if you don't mind. One of them has to do with the fact that in the letter that you sent me, you noted that you served in the National Guard and the National Reserve for a while after your active duty service was over.
Yeah.
How long was that?
I was still in Auburn. And that was 3 years that it took me to get through Auburn.
Okay. So
I started out with the Naval Reserve, and they would fly us from Opelika, which is a little town near Auburn, to Atlanta, and we'd drill over the weekend.
Right.
And then they'd bring us back. And one day the captain over there said, I have to tell you fellas that we're afraid to bring you over on this plane anymore because they're not that good. And
yikes.
if you want to continue with the Naval Reserve, it says that, and you can get over here, well, you can stay here, you know?
Sure.
So I had no way of getting over there, so I got out.
Uh-huh.
And then at Opelika, Alabama, it was a National Guard unit.
Right.
And so I said, well, I'll get in the National Guard.
Uh-huh.
And one day a guy at the National Guard unit says, I see here that you're in the Naval Reserve and the National Guard, too. I says, yeah. He says, you can't do that. I says, well, okay, what? He says, you got to pick one or the other. I says, well, I won't pick any one.
I'll pick neither.
So that's how I got out.
Okay,
know?
And that would have been what, about 1940?
See, I went up there in 46.
So 49 or so?
Yeah, maybe 48.
Oh, 48.
Yeah.
About just a year later or so, the Korean War broke out. Did you ever feel that they might call you back in
the
service?
No, I didn't know much about that.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
You were never, you didn't never felt like they might come in.
No.
And impress you back in. Of course, you were older than some of the other guys who had served in World War II.
Yeah.
You know, you were born in 1919, so
you
were a little bit older.
Yeah.
And that probably helped out in that.
Uh-huh.
And also, you had children by this time.
Yeah.
Too. So, I just wanted to ask another question, Bill. You know, now folks looking back on World War II, younger people like me, I'm in my 40s, you know, we look back and we think about the people who served in World War II, and we tend to call you now the greatest generation. I'm sure you've heard that.
Yes.
What do you think of that? Were you the generation that did your duty?
Yeah.
Or was there more to it than that?
Well, you see, one of my uncles died in the First World War.
Is that right?
Yeah, and my great-grandfather died in the Civil War, and one died in the Indian War. And but I just figured that it's something you have to do when you're there.
Yes, sir.
And I suppose they had the same idea. Maybe some of them were drafted in, like, even in World War II.
Sure.
And I sometimes ask myself, if I hadn't been in the Navy when the war broke out, would I have volunteered? And I know I would because I had kinfolks that did, you see.
Yes.
And
yes.
I don't know. If we could all get along together, it would be wonderful.
It sure would.
It's not going to be that. It never has been. And now we're faced, and we thought maybe we could help other people. I think we helped Japan out.
With what we did after the war?
Yes, we put them on their feet.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
We sent our scrap iron over there to them for them to send back on Pearl Harbor Day. But now it's worked out fine. We helped those people. We could help those over there, but they're fighting among themselves, you see.
Meaning the ones in Iraq.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how can you help somebody when they can't even get along together?
Well, you know, you mentioned that you had a great-grandfather who was killed in the Civil War.
Yeah.
Now, would I be right in saying that he was on the Confederate side fighting from Alabama?
Yeah, he was.
Yes, sir. And do you know anything about the story? Have you researched where he was killed or what the circumstances were?
Yeah.
Because that's real interesting, too.
I can't remember now, you know, but that's one thing that's showing up with me is remembering something. I'll remember a little later, you know.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll tell you, we'll have another chance to, if it does come to you, to include it in the record.
Uh-huh. But
you had a grandfather who was killed in the Civil War.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What about your uncle in World War One? What do you know about him?
I didn't know him, but I have pictures of him, even with the things that he had to carry with him, you know. I know that he was wounded in France.
Was he in the army then? He was in the U.S. Army. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then he was a Mason, and there's a doctor that was a Mason, and you know, people in these groups stick together.
Yes, sir.
Even
yes.
if it's college today and time.
Yes, that's
and,
right.
So they shipped him back to New York,
and
he died. And then his wife went up there to stay with him in New York, but he died while he was in New York from the wound that he got overseas, but was able to get back to the States.
So his wife did see him before he died?
Pardon?
Did his wife see him before he died?
Oh, yeah, she was there with him.
Okay. Well, that had to be some comfort to her. But as you say, the United States has been involved in a number of conflicts over time.
Yeah, and I have pictures of him in his army uniform, you know.
Well, I bet he cut a fine figure.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, is there anything else that you'd like to add to the oral history interview before we wrap it up? Anything I haven't asked you about?
I don't know. You could get down and go back over and reminisce and go a little deeper
sure.
in the thing, but we can't do that. But I think we've pretty well covered it.
Okay, well.
And I'll say one other thing.
Yes, please.
About Queenie.
Yes, sir.
She has covered, and you met personally. Did you meet Claude Crowley personally?
I did meet him personally. Yes, sir.
I'll tell you right now, it's good to live right within walking distance, right down the street. In fact, I think it was day before yesterday, he dropped by here and brought me something. I give him something from time to time.
He's a fine gentleman.
Oh, and he helped me take my wife out to the mammogram examination here recently. And he told me, Bill said, I want to tell you, I appreciate you asking me to help you. And he says, I want you to know that anytime you need the help, you call on me.
He is a fine gentleman.
Yeah, and I have his autobiography, a copy of it, and I've read it twice. See, he was in the Soil Conservation Service.
Yes, that's
and
right.
Had the same job I had until he got promoted to the information outfit out here, you see.
Uh-huh.
And then I got here. And
you two were practically separated at birth.
Yeah.
Because he served in the Navy, of course, as well.
Yeah, he was on a destroyer.
Yeah, he was on the Richard B. Anderson.
Yeah, but...
And a finer gentleman I will never meet, I'm sure.
Oh, he's perfect.
And his wife as well, very sweet.
Oh, yeah.
Very sweet.
I was glad they went, you know, and he told me all about it, showed me some pictures and everything.
Mm-hmm.
We share about everything. I got a mustard patch growing in my garden now, and he loves mustard, so I keep them supplied with mustard.
Well, there you go. Well, you two guys have got it pretty much worked out, and I'm very pleased for you.
Yeah, we got a lot in common now.
Yeah, and to have a great friend like that nearby is always a comfort.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you for taking the time today to participate in the Oral History Project.
Well, it's my pleasure, and
I appreciate it, sir.
I think it's, I'm like you're doing now, and he and I get the Naval History magazine and always pass it on to him.
Yes, sir.
And they have a new head of that thing now, and it looks like, in fact, there's a little dog story in the last issue,
uh-huh.
and neither one of us could remember that those admirals that write to that magazine, and mm-hmm. then when another one writes, they argue about whether he was right or wrong, and so we think that it's in a better way by writing some things that the people that were out there on the ground fighting too that don't get much publicity, you know.
Yes, sir, and that's exactly why we're interviewing you and Claude and the other folks. That's exactly why we're doing it.
It's because of Claude now that I got this interview.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh.
And I'm gonna write him a note and tell him what a good job you did.
Well, I appreciate it. I told him I was scared. He said, "Bill, don't worry. So she's gonna take care of it."
Well, thank you, Bill.
Okay, and good luck.